From the creators of the hit kids podcast Who Smarted and Netflix's Brainchild comes the adventurous world of mysteries about true histories, affectionately known as math. Every episode follows Max and Molly, who have just been recruited into a secret order of problem solvers, on an adventure through time, packed with puzzles, hidden equations, history, and laughs, making learning cool. It's perfect for ages 6 and up. New episodes drop every Thursday, and they're 15 minutes long, which is perfect for a car ride or break time or bedtime. And each episode is stacked with so much laughter that your kiddos won't even realize how much they're learning. So tune into Mysteries About True Histories with your kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods. Hello, you sentient ball of stardust. Welcome to Struggle Care. I'm your host, Casey Davis, and today I want to talk about the book Beyond Fragility. I actually have two of the three authors in the studio with me. I have Dr. Natalie Watson-Singleton and Dr. Yara Makawi. We don't have Danielle Dawson with us, who is a PhD candidate, so soon to be doctor. But I did want to start by just saying that this is truly the best anti-racism resource that I have ever read or encountered.
Yeah, high praise. Yeah, incredible.
Truly, I mean that as a white person, and I mean that as a clinician. It's so powerful to have women who are psychologists, who are clinicians, who have this like very advanced level of research and learning, marry together this idea of anti-racism and psychologically, like, what do we need to do to get to that place? So let's start with this. Will you guys just introduce yourselves?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us. We're so excited to be here. I am Dr. Yara Makawi. I'm a psychology professor, and my research and my teaching really focuses on racism and anti-racism. And I'm also a co-founder of the Dialectical Engagement and Anti-Racism Project, or the DEAR Project.
Yeah, and I'm Dr. Natalie Watson-Singleton. Also happy to be here. A psychology professor, licensed clinical psychologist, and co-founder of DEAR. And my research focuses on understanding racism and racism-related disparities that impact the lives of African Americans.
And then can you give us a synopsis about Danielle?
Sure. I think Danielle also is interested in understanding health disparities in Black populations and does some really cool stuff even around like technology-based interventions.
Awesome. So I mentioned that this is like the best book I've read, and it is set apart for me because of your kind of unique backgrounds and what you brought to the table around that. Can you tell me, like, how did your organization start, first of all, and then how did it become this book?
Great question. So it all started in the dark year of 2020. So it was after the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. And, you know, I don't know if you recall, but that was kind of the time where a lot of white folks were waking up to the reality of racism. There were a lot of Facebook groups about allies. I was in one of them, and I, you know, will never forget. There was a white person who, you know, she was doing her best, but she kind of was going on this rant where she was just like, you know, I give up. You just can't win. You know, one second I'm being told, use your voice, speak up, and then I'm doing that, and then people are criticizing me and telling me to stay in my lane or to not center myself. Like, you know, what are you supposed to do? And, you know, she was clearly kind of in that process of just, you know, throwing her hands. You can't see my hands in the podcast, but I'm throwing them up theatrically. And I remember just taking a screenshot and sending it to Natalie and then later sending it to Danielle and just saying, I think white allies need dialectics. I think that is what's going on because they are getting really stuck in this either or thinking. And I can see the consequences with my own eyes of kind of pulling back. And so they both agreed. They both loved dialectical behavior therapy as much as I do, which we'll talk about more later, hopefully. But we got together and we wrote a Medium article called How to Not Be a Karen, Managing the Tensions of Anti-Racist Allyship. And that really marked the birth of DEAR. And so it really started with this idea of dialectics and that one article. And then we started to realize that more was needed beyond just dialectics. And that's kind of how the whole enterprise of skills were created.
And I think because we're academics, we naturally have ideas and then share them by writing. And I remember having a conversation with Yara and Danielle and being like, And we need, if we're going to talk about skills being so important, we also need opportunities to train white allies in skill building. And so I think that's how the organization continued to grow.
So one question that I have, if you could sort of, for like the lay people listening who are going dialectics, DBT, like maybe they've heard that idea of DBT therapy before. Can you give us a synopsis of what that is and how it might be different from like traditional talk therapy that people have experienced?
Yeah, so DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, is an evidence-based psychotherapy approach that incorporates cognitive behavioral approaches. So thinking about our thoughts, thinking about our behaviors. It also incorporates some mindfulness and acceptance-based strategies. And dialectic, how I like to describe it, is just a fancy way of talking about balance, balancing things that often feel in opposition of each other. And so from a DBT perspective, you're trying to balance acceptance and change. It would seem counterintuitive that you would both accept and change things. And so DBT has a set of skills that support folks in accepting really difficult emotions, accepting things that we can't change, but also working to change the things that we can, perhaps improving our relationships, improving our ability to manage our emotions. And we felt that that provided a really nice framework for anti-racism. Granted, we also pull from other approaches, but really leaned into this idea of supporting folks with managing difficult emotions, knowing when to tolerate them, when to change them, becoming more aware of their thoughts, becoming more aware of their behaviors, and how those things were either moving them in the direction of anti-racism or getting in the way.
Right. And, you know, when I first heard the title of the book, Beyond Fragility, obviously what came to mind was Dr. Robin DiAngelo's book, right? You know, White Fragility. And so was that on purpose for those titles to almost talk to each other?
Absolutely. In a respectful way, right? So it's not contentious. Dr. Robin DiAngelo has also endorsed the book. And what we appreciated about White Fragility and the popularity of White Fragility is that it really woke folks up to racism and white privilege in the ways that Yara had mentioned earlier. And White Fragility, like a lot of other anti-racism resources, are very knowledge-based. So teaching people about what racism is and what anti-racism is. And our book is about going beyond just acquiring knowledge to actually acquiring the skills needed to apply that knowledge and really show up as anti-racist allies.
One of the things I loved about the book is that you systematically go through like all of the different barriers, like internal barriers, the emotional barriers, the cognitive barriers, like the behavioral barriers, like all of these barriers that I know I have felt as a white person. And I remember, and they aren't like you, they're not like specific anti-racism, or they're not only anti-racism skills, right? Like I'm reading this and as a therapist, I'm going like, these aren't emotional regulation skills. These are, you know, CBT skills. These are cognitive skills. These are flexibility skills. These are, you know, widening your window of tolerance. Like these are the skills. And remember, you know, in 2020, shortly after the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, I joined an anti-racism cohort and it was a very interactive, you know, there were parts that we were learning, but there were also parts where we were being challenged and we were sharing. And, you know, the woman who was leading would directly challenge as we were talking, you know, hey, you just said it this way. Have you ever asked yourself why you said that? Hey, I'm hearing this belief under that. Like, where did that come from? And as we were doing that, it almost had some similar feels as not, it wasn't like a group therapy session, but it's that similar, like not just sitting back and learning, not lecturing, right? And when we watched each other struggle, and when I struggled in it, one of the things that I thought the whole time was like, damn, I'm not saying that I'm like a super great anti-racist white person, but all I could think about was how I felt very advantaged by the fact that I had gone to rehab for 18 months and they spent so much time building ego strength. Like I had to sit there in rehab and listen to people be like, when you do this, it has a negative impact on me. And that I think might be a shitty part about you. And I had to learn to like, listen to that and regulate my emotions and tolerate that and go, ooh, that didn't feel good, but where's the truth in it? Without jumping to be defensive and having, you know, in denial about my own things and, but do it with the kind of like self-compassion so that I wouldn't like crumble under like, I'm so bad. And I would remember looking around and being like, man, you really can't do that, this work without those skills. Like some of these people, their issue isn't that they're unwilling to be anti-racist. It's that nobody ever taught them those emotional regulation skills. Like when someone says, hey, that was racist, and my whole body tenses up and I go, oh God, oh God, oh God, I don't want to be racist. I don't want to be racist. I don't think I was racist, but maybe everyone thinks I'm racist, and everything kind of starts to spin out of control. Like that's where the work is, it seems like.
Absolutely. And as you were talking, I think it brings up a really important point that we talk about in the book, which is sometimes it can feel a little confusing, you know, especially to like sociologists and anyone who thinks about racism as being or understands how systemic racism can be. And thinking about emotions can feel so small. But I think like you're saying, at the end of the day, even when you think about systemic processes, they're still maintained by, encouraged by individual people. Like I was just emailing the Kentucky Senate yesterday about some anti-DEI bills. And it was just really interesting to read some of the things that people are so worried about. And, you know, one of those things similar to what's been passed in Florida was like, you know, like you can't basically, it's like, this is obviously not what they say, but the implication is like, you can't make people feel bad. In my email to these state senators, I was saying, you know, I've been teaching about this stuff for a decade and like people can learn to cope with the emotions. If I am teaching someone about the history of the United States or just talking about specific things and they feel shame, that's completely normal. It's non-pathological and it's not harmful to feel those emotions. And it's not because of their race. It's because it's normal to feel that way when you hear about those things, right? And I think that people have a hard time coping with it and then don't even want to expose people to the information so that there's no need for that to even develop. And so I think all of the kind of individual, cultural, systemic things are really linked.
I was just going to say, you know, Yara's point too made me think about one of our skills, the facts skill, which is kind of connected to DBT's checking the facts, right? Just because I feel bad doesn't mean something bad is happening to me or learning about DEI or anti-racism is bad. And so one of our skills, right, really supports people in disentangling the stories that we tell ourselves when we're emotionally activated.
Isn't it ironic, like just as a tangent, that the people who want to dismantle DEI and historically accurate teachings about our country and the enslavement of Black people and all the resulting oppression are the same people that like to proudly pronounce that like facts don't care about your feelings? Like they'll say horrendously phobic shit and they'll be like, I'm just saying the truth. It's not my fault if you have feelings about it. I'm like, where did that line of thinking suddenly right. not apply to you because you don't want to feel bad?
Right.
You know, I also wanted to say that one of the reasons I think that this book was so, man, like, I feel like my love language is like, just like intellectual discourse. I feel like I interject it into my veins, but not just the lofty stuff, like the stuff that has like such practical implications. And this is another tangent. I'm sorry. We have such a beautiful outline for this episode and the Vyvanse is kicking. And I feel so excited to have you guys here that I just want to share. So actually in the middle of writing my own book about relationships, it's basically like a little handbook for when you struggle with relationships, platonic, romantic, familial, all of these. And specifically, this idea that, you know, how do we have better relationships? And how do you write a book about all of those and not accidentally like tell someone to stay when they shouldn't, leave when they shouldn't, and, you know, all these kind of things. But one of the biggest things in the relationship book that I've been writing about is there's this concept called the vulnerability cycle, about how, like, it was made for marriage therapy, about like how interpersonal conflict happens and how like our own vulnerabilities and sensitivities get triggered and we respond in a certain way and we kind of spiral out and get activated into fight or flight, and how like the most important skill you can have for having better relationships is the skill of emotional regulation. And it was something that I used to teach a lot when I did workshops for drug rehabs. And so it was so interesting to be in the process of that in my own book and then to read yours and be like, yes, this is it. Like, this is the key to like all to unlocking all of these skills. And you say about the book that it is a book for white people that does not center whiteness. And I certainly felt that, but I'd love to hear from you guys, like what you mean by that.
Yeah. I think that at the end of the day, you know, when you think about what whiteness means and what whiteness does, there's a lot of centering of emotions. There's a lot of prioritizing the comfort of white folks, even within anti-racist spaces. You know, how do you say things in a way that people aren't going to be offended? You know, there's all this like tiptoeing and desire for white comfort. And that is not what we are about in this book. And so it's not designed to make white people feel good and comfortable. And it's really about the end goal of doing effective anti-racist work. And so even though it's a book for white people, it centers people of color and that the end goal is a society that's no longer harmful to people of color.
And yet the book, when I read it, I felt like I was talking to a therapist that had unconditional positive regard for me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I felt like I was listening to someone that was very safe for both reasons. It felt safe because it did not feel like your goal was for me to feel bad. But it also didn't feel like your goal was for me to feel good either. Like, your goal was to tell me the truth and to understand why those truths may be hard, and then teach me the skills to deal with that hardness so that I could walk forward in the truth.
I was going to say, I'm just really happy to hear you say that because I think it's really consistent with our goal and also, you know, aligned with the fact that, you know, that we are therapists and, you know, we knew kind of our long-term goal, which we're now doing, is to provide, you know, like CE workshops to therapists. And so that's always kind of been our framing. Like, it's, we don't have that kind of approach of yelling, shaming. I think we don't think that's effective and at the same time, not coddling. So it's really great to hear it being received the way that we intended.
And so the book talks about 16 different skills. And I loved that they were all acronyms.
That's Yara.
They all were like,
that's all Yara.
I love that so much. And you also mentioned, like, I want to get into the skills and some of the examples, but one of the reasons you say that you're uniquely positioned to write this book, and I think that does have to do with being clinical community psychologists. Like, you're trained to think about people at a societal level, at an individual level, with this really practical what works.
Absolutely. I think our therapeutic training, working with a diverse array of clients, really supported us into thinking about these skills. And I can't also ignore sort of our lived experience as three women of color who have been on the receiving end of a lot of ineffectiveness. Thinking about that situation that I encountered, how would I have wanted a white person to show up? How would I have wanted this to play out differently? And so I think it really is a reflection of our lived experiences, our clinical training, our research, which also made it a joy to write.
Are you frustrated by buying your kids clothes and having them grow out of them within a week? Do they itch, pinch, and they just aren't comfortable? Well, then you need to check out Posh Peanut. Made from this amazing bamboo material, the clothes are legitimately so soft and they stretch with your kids as they grow. They are 4 times stretchier than cotton. Made to last, loved by parents, and approved by kids. Posh Peanut makes thoughtfully crafted, beautiful and stylish clothing for kids and families designed in-house from beautiful florals to all of your favorite brands such as Hot Wheels, Disney, Hello Kitty, and Barbie. Their pieces are made with that ridiculously soft fabric, and it even stays soft wash after wash after wash. Right now, Posh Peanut is offering our listeners 20% off your first order with promo code STRUGGLE. Go to poshpeanut.com/struggle and use promo code STRUGGLE for 20% off your first order. That's poshpeanut.com/struggle, promo code STRUGGLE. Shout out to Claritin for giving me some free samples and for sponsoring this podcast. I am a seasonal allergy sufferer, which means that sometimes I'm lying in bed reading a book that is super happy and my husband says, "What's wrong? Why are you crying?" Because I am sniffling and he thinks I'm crying. But no, it's just seasonal allergies. Luckily, that does not happen anymore because I use Claritin D. We can live Claritin clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has 2 powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sniffing, sneezing, watery eyes, itchy nose and throat. It's great. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. As for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter, you don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin clear. Use as directed. I still remember where I was the first time it hit me. I maybe do have ADHD. And it's funny, I posted a TikTok the other day about having ADHD, and a good friend of mine texted me and said, "Remember when you swore to me you didn't have ADHD?" Oh, goodness. Well, listen, if you relate to that at any point in your life, I want to share a podcast that you should tune into. It's called ADHD Aha, hosted by Laura Key. It's candid stories from people who share the moment it clicked that they or someone they know has ADHD. In each episode, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, and even funny ways that ADHD symptoms can surface for adults. And it doesn't always look the way we thought it would. So check it out. To listen to ADHD Aha, search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha, with Aha spelled A-H-A. One of the things I also really loved and felt convicted by as I read it, or kind of like, ooh, is that you teach all these skills, and then, but you also teach, like, one of the skills you teach is like how to call out like fellow white people, and you teach it, and we'll get into it later, but you teach it in this specific way that really puts a gut check on, like, how do you say this? Like, this isn't your time to power trip, which I think is one of the biggest temptations, right? You get that like Dunning-Kruger, like, okay, I know a little bit, and now I see somebody quote unquote doing it wrong, and we can do what we think we're being told to do. But you really give us those like step by step, not only like, what am I saying it, but like, what's going on inside of me when I'm addressing this, and how can I be effective? And I just loved that. Okay. So one thing that I got instant clarity with is you said that there's this like North Star principle that's supposed to guide all of our decisions, and it is the DBT skill of effectiveness. So can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I think kind of, you know, some of what we've been talking about already is effectiveness is about really thinking about what works. So not getting caught up in what you think should happen, what feels right or fair to you, right? So not getting stuck on those components, but really thinking about what works, which we know is a pivotal shift, because it's easy to get attached to this particular way of doing. And one of the things that we've noticed, even in when we offer these trainings, people really struggle with not having a checklist. Like, okay, but no, tell us what the list is in terms of how to be an ally that's going to work in every situation. And it's like, well, that's not the reality of anti-racism. It really requires thinking critically about what is it that I'm trying to accomplish that's aligned with my anti-racism values, and what's going to move me forward.
It immediately brought to mind like one of my early experiences on TikTok when I first started my channel. And there was this trend going around where it was like people who kind of like quote unquote looked like career people or professional people. And then they would do this sort of like, nobody knows that like I used to be. And then like, you know, these scruffy little whatevers. And mine was like, nobody would expect that I used to be this like little hippie with dreadlocks. And that was the only part of whatever. And there was a woman of color who got really upset and was like, you know, I don't like how you made the fact that you engage in cultural appropriation as this like tee-hee moment. And so there was like some back and forth in the comments. And I remember thinking like, well, that wasn't what I meant to do. But like, I guess I'm sorry if it happened or whatever. But it kind of like created its own little firestorm controversy, whatever, whatever. And there was a lot of hounding around like, okay, you need to take accountability, take accountability, take it. I remember thinking like, accountable to who? Like, I didn't hurt you. I don't have them now. I don't have that. And I was trying to do like the intellectual, like, here's what I know about anti-racism, but like, this isn't plugging into that. Like, I've done it. I followed the script. I did the things. You're not allowed to be mad at me anymore. Like, this isn't fair. It's not fair. And so you open this book by giving this example of a head of school that just started and gets a letter from students of color saying like, here are the things in the school that like we think are like, you know, oppressive or discriminating. And she gets really defensive about like, I just got here. I didn't do these things. And I immediately thought of that TikTok of me being like, this isn't fair. This isn't fair. I did what I was supposed to do. I did the apology. I did the whatever. I don't have to keep, you know, bending over backwards just because every single person doesn't, and like voicing those things out loud. And then there's this line that just shoots you through the heart where you say, instead of focusing on what you think is fair, ask yourself, what is the most effective thing to do in this situation to advance anti-racism? And that to me was like, this book's going to be different, right? Like, this is the shift. It's not about, are you right or wrong necessarily, or is this fair, or are you being misunderstood, or, you know, you have to do this just because of that. It is, what next step could I take? Because then, even if I think I'm wrong, that question applies. Even if I think I'm right, or I've been misunderstood, or whatever, it still applies. Like, that, the literal question of how I can decenter myself, there is still a way to handle this situation where I can engage in like my own anti-racism and further anti-racism. Or, and isn't that the truth? Like, a lot of times it's like the way we as white people are responding to whatever's been pointed out. That's where we like go wrong, for lack of a better term.
100%. I mean, that's why the whole repair chapter exists. And I think one of the things that came up for me as you were sharing that story was, even, you know, in the repair, you know, one of the letters has to do with an apology. And part of what we encourage and think is really important is noting that even if you apologize, you can't demand forgiveness, right? And so in addition to doing what's effective, I think even when you engage in as best as you can as a repair process, kind of knowing that people might still be upset, and it's not helpful to then be mad at them for not accepting your apology.
So you open up with talking about like barriers to anti-racism work. And I thought these were really insightful. You talked about cognitive barriers. And I just want to read a couple of these for the audience. You talked about, okay, so have you ever wondered why people kept hanging on to racism and that racism was a thing in the past? Have you ever gotten stuck trying to figure out the right way to be an ally? Have you ever believed that not seeing race was the best way to overcome racial prejudice? And then you have the emotional barriers, the fear of being perceived as a bad ally, the unbearable guilt of having unearned privilege. Oh, and that's the other thing, is I feel like, you know, for a lot of us that maybe have done the work around some of these ones about like not seeing race and racism's a thing of the past, and we're into that, like, no, I'm all in, it's definitely a problem, it's definitely a this. There's this like second wave of barriers that you discover in yourself after you've bought in that you are specifically speaking to, right? Frustration that your anti-racism efforts have gone unnoticed. Powerlessness about your ability to make a difference. Anxiety that you might say something or do something to make the situation worse. Oh, I felt like you were reading like my journal with these. And then you talk about interpersonal barriers. Have you ever been unsure about what to say to BIPOC peers following a racist incident? Hesitant to call out a racist remark enacted by a colleague or family member? Uncertain about how to apologize after making a racist misstep? I love that you called it a misstep. Was that intentional, the word misstep?
As opposed to what, like mistake?
Like, as opposed to mistake or wrong or screw up, or like, there was just something so like powerful in what it implied and didn't imply, in the way that it was. It's like, okay, it might be my fault, or it might be a mistake, or it might have been a truly like a, what am I trying to say? Like an honest mistake. But like, either way, a misstep is my responsibility.
In response to, you know, is it intentional? I would say, based on the fact that we probably met for hundreds and hundreds of hours about every little detail of the book, everything was intentional, every single word. And I think, you know, throughout, we have a lot of kind of analogies and metaphors about journeys and paths. And so I think missteps is kind of consistent with that way of thinking of going on a path, and is also kind of general enough to encompass a lot of different things. And so that would be my post hoc guess for why we were intentional about that one.
I was just going to say, I think we are also trying to, we're clear that we don't understand these barriers as like moral failings or like character flaws. They exist because of lack of skills, like you've talked about previously. And none of us showed up with this kind of innate essence on how to be an ally. We have to learn how to do it. And so I think that tone and tenor is really reflected in the book.
Yeah, I feel like what it does is it helps me avoid like the shame trap. Like, it's not trying to necessarily make me feel comfortable, but like the quickest way for me to center myself at this stage for me is when I start to feel a lot of shame over having done a misstep. But then I fall into that hole of, what do people think? Are people going to like me? How am I going to fix this? Oh, I'm such a bad ally. Like, that's how it, all of a sudden I become the gravitational pull of the whole issue. And misstep neutralizes that a little bit for me.
And I think some of what we talk about in that section of the book is people get really hung up on their intentions. intentions and trying to argue what they intended to do or not intend to do. And I think part of using that neutral language makes it clear that in some ways we're agnostic about what you intended to do. It really is about the impact and how to continue to respond effectively.
Let's get into these skills. You discuss a lot of DBT skills specifically in the book and ways that they can be used in anti-racism work. And even though DBT wasn't created specifically for anti-racism work, it really does seem to like perfectly apply. And so I want to talk about, when you talk about cognitive skills, there's a lot of them, but there's one specific one. One of the ways that you address moving through like cognitive barriers is this skill set you refer to as tapping into your best self. And I want to read just this little excerpt. Tapping into your best self means reminding yourself of your motivation for engaging in this work. It is the difference between saying, wow, I made a racist comment and now everybody will think I'm a horrible person, and I made a racist misstep and I know I can do better. Talk to me about this skill, because I feel like it strikes me as doing like several things at once, this shift to like that inner talk.
Yeah. And I think because our skills are acronyms, they all require you to do multiple things at the same time to address a particular issue. And so that tapping into your best self is a part of the ACCEPT skill, which was designed to help people move from denying racism to accepting or acknowledging the reality of racism. And so tapping into your best self is about reminding yourself why you're engaged in this work. Getting caught up on whether or not you endorsed a worldview that supported racism or maintained racism, like arguing or trying to maintain this belief, is not helpful in moving forward. So reminding yourself, why are you here? Why are you engaged in this work? And are you willing to let go of these beliefs to do this work meaningfully? Also reminding yourself of your values, right? Like if you're very much about connecting with your anti-racist values, that's going to require you to let go beliefs or worldviews like, I don't see color, right? Or I don't see race, to do this work effectively.
It strikes me as very self-soothing, because part of what happens is like we have this whole construct around, I can't be loved or accepted unless I'm seen as a good person. And so when racism is pointed out to me, like I have this tailspin of, I really need you to know I'm a good person. I really need you to know. And I think you laid out kind of perfectly in the book, like why that is not an effective response. Like it might be an understandable response, but it is not an effective response and it will harm people in the process. And so there's something very self-soothing about going, what is important here, right? Is it important? And one of the things that I did the last time that I had that moment that was really helpful, taken exactly from this, right, was I asked myself, is it important to me that everyone knows I'm doing, like, what am I trying to do? Am I trying to make sure that everyone knows I'm doing the right thing? Or am I trying to make sure I'm doing the right thing? And that small flip of like, you know, what can I do next to advance anti-racism? Or like my old cohort used to put it in context of like, which next step will best serve the cause of Black liberation. And so I just think you did that brilliantly. It's like, it's not about me saying, you're okay. It doesn't matter. You're still a good person. It's like, that's not even the question.
Yeah, that's not what this is about.
And I appreciate, you know, what it also made me think about, going back to Yara's point earlier about this is a book that's for white folks, but that doesn't center whiteness. If we think about, you know, a movement toward Black liberation, it's a lot to ask Black folks to pat white allies on the back when they're trying to maintain their own survival, right? And so part of divesting from this idea that you want to be seen as a good ally is about letting go of the need for, I think Yara talks about it as like the ally could, right? Or the pat on the back. No, folks of color are too busy trying to survive to slow down and give you praise or affirmation, even though we understand the desire for praise and affirmation, for doing the work that allies say they're committed to doing.
Well, it reminded me of like, you know, thinking about these as human skills, that like everyone experiences that feeling of threat, that feeling of fight or flight, that feeling of dysregulation when there's conflict and things like that. And that if you are someone who's been directly harmed, or you are of the same group that is being talked about in a harmful way in that moment, it's not as if you aren't having to do internal work in that moment yourselves around that fear and that wounding and that anger and that, like, you're having to regulate yourself. And so it's like you said, like, it's not like it's not understandable to like need affirmation, but like, I can't, like, I don't need the affirmation from someone who is trying to, like, you don't need to do your work and my work. So this idea of going from the black and white thinking to using that skill of and, right? I'm doing my best and I can do better. It reminded me of, well, never mind. That's a tangent. Okay. Speaking of fight or flight, what does, this was so powerful in your book, but what does fight or flight have to do with anti-racism?
Yeah, I think what we're, again, trying to take a non-judgmental approach is helping people understand why they're having the reactions that they are, right? Some of it is connected to our belief system. Some of it is connected to our socialization. And some of it is very much connected to our physiology, right? We are physiologically hardwired to respond to threatening information to maintain our survival. What happens, though, is, you know, having a bear walk across your path, which is an immediate threat, is not the same as someone thinking you are racist. However, physiologically, folks can have the same reaction. And so it was about helping people understand the physiological hardwiring, why they're having these reactions, and also being able to take a step back and say, even though my body is telling me that I am unsafe or that there is a threat, is a social threat, right? Or being perceived as racist, an actual like threat to my immediate safety? And if not, how does that influence how I then show up? Because when we are physiologically aroused, again, fight or flight, what do we want to do? Fight back, defend ourselves, which is not oftentimes an effective anti-racist response, or we want to flee. So disengage and avoid. And whether you're coming off defensively or disengaging from the work, it's not helpful to sustained anti-racist work.
You know, you talk about writing the article about how not to be a Karen. And many times when I watch those interactions, that is always what I, it's like, that is a person in full blown fight or flight. And that's not to excuse their behavior, but just from a psychological perspective, being like, that person is in fight or flight. And I remember being in rehab and we had to do these like confrontation meetings where people would tell you what was wrong with you, like the shitty ways you were showing up in the world. And you would, like, you would go into full blown fight or flight. And we had this rule that when you were confronted, you were not allowed to say anything but okay to like make you sit with that feeling. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was writing through this idea, reading through your fight or flight kind of chapter, is that you describe it as like your body telling you you're not safe. But even that, like, it took a shift for me to realize that that's what the signal was saying, because I always thought that that signal was saying, you're right, you're right, you're right. And not you're right as in like, I should win the argument, but like, I'm the victim right now. I am correct. You are coming against me, but no, I'm right. And I remember that little thing of having to just say, okay, was the hardest part for me. And I understood the rule and I kept breaking it because I would literally feel almost like a narrative, like, okay, no, I understand I shouldn't respond. But like in this one instance, I actually am right. Like if you had more information, if you needed, and so like, it was like that, the first shift was having to go from realizing that that feeling isn't actually saying I'm right. It's just saying that I'm not safe. And like you said, just because it feels not safe doesn't mean that I'm not safe.
Right. That in this moment I am encountering a threat, but is it an actual threat to safety or is it a perceived threat because it calls into question my perceived standing as a good ally?
And like the powerful knowledge that like our brain doesn't actually know the difference between physical threat and emotional threat. So you have, I want to read a little excerpt that you say, the idea that you are a good person, quotes, has been threatened, activating your fight or flight response. When situations like this occur, you have a choice to resist the unpleasant emotions or willingly engage with the discomfort. For many people, the initial impulse is to turn away. While this may feel better in the moment, resisting difficult emotions makes it difficult for you to reflect on your missteps and consider the source of bias that may have led to these missteps. And I think most white people, if we are really honest with ourselves, when we watch Karen encounters of somebody dysregulating and dissolving and whatever. I think if we were really honest, we would recognize that many versions of that is what's happening inside of us in these moments. When we feel challenged, when we feel called out, when we feel like, I'm not sure about that. And you talk about how like we can reframe the negative self-talk with more helpful things. And your suggestion is, I'm feeling ashamed because I think others may believe I'm a horrible person for the offhand comment I made. How can I move forward in a way that is consistent with my anti-racist values? And so, like you said, this doesn't disengage you from the discomfort, but it saves you from the shame trap. Right? That you'll kind of like fall down the rabbit hole of this is all about me and all I have to do is think about myself and right? Like you're still, right? And I think that's really interesting. Like when we start this journey and we see everything through the lens of whiteness and everything is white and white is the default and white is the important part and white is the whatever. And we're always thinking about ourselves. And sometimes we can go through a lot of anti-racist education, but not get rid of that same framing. And now in every encounter, instead of thinking about what I deserve, I'm thinking about how I'm screwing up. It's like, I haven't actually disengaged from centering whiteness in that way. Okay, next question. One of the things that really hit me as a therapist is this idea that you can't do the effective anti-racist work outside of your window of tolerance. And for anyone who doesn't know what window of tolerance is, it just means that there's this certain window of stress that you can experience and cope with fairly easily. And then as you move outside of your window of tolerance, either because something is really stressful to you, you become less effective at regulating your emotions and your behavior. And if you continue to escalate, you'll go right into that fight or flight stance. And this idea that emotional regulation skills are anti-racist skills, I think is what makes your book so unique and powerful. And one of the skills that you offer about emotional regulation is called feel. And so I wanted to highlight that one for the episode. Can you talk to me about FEEL?
Yeah. So FEEL, obviously, like all the other skills, is an acronym. And it really is about, it's a distress tolerance skill, right? So it's designed to help you tolerate difficult emotions, which I appreciate what you said earlier about like these skills being human skills. Whether it's anti-racism or not, we all have to encounter difficult moments where we can't immediately change the situation, the context, or what we're feeling. And so we have to learn how to tolerate that. And so we have to find our center. So giving ourselves space free from distractions to really check in with the body, being able to embody a non-judgmental stance. So approaching how we're feeling with a sense of curiosity rather than judgment, right? And then allowing ourselves the opportunity to check in with our senses, to ground ourselves. So noticing what we might be smelling in the moment, seeing in the moment, tasting in the moment, again, as an opportunity to self-soothe. And really also recognizing that difficult emotions and experiencing difficult emotions are what make us human, right? Again, you are not a bad ally because you're feeling shame or feeling guilt. You're not a bad person because you may even be feeling anger, right? You're not a weak person because you're feeling these emotions. They're part of the human experience.
Yeah. And I think just to add on to what Natalie's saying, I think that's why the detect skill about figuring out what the emotion even is and then followed by feel, that was really intentional because you really kind of need to master those and kind of develop that emotion literacy to then do more advanced skills, like with the reframing that you were referring to earlier, like with the fact skill, which is, you know, really the closest, I think, skill to like traditional CBT, where it's challenging that interpretation, which is what actually leads to the emotion and kind of fact checking yourself. And so mastering feel is really necessary for that to happen. And, you know, you were talking about the Karens, and I just, you know, I remember the Central Park one. That was like the first one that always comes to mind. And I always just kind of imagine like, what would it have been like for these white women to, you know, pause and do the detect skill and do the feel skill? Like, I wonder if they had tried that for just a moment, they would have then figured out that they needed to do a little bit more checking of what's going on within themselves. Maybe they would have done the fact skill and eventually kind of would lead to the conclusion that they are not being threatened in this situation, that there is a possibility that bias is interpreting their behavior. And maybe there is some more kind of consideration of what it means for them to make the decision to call the police in a situation like that. And then the whole thing can be prevented. So that's always what I think about when I see those instances.
And you're right that like all of these skills are, they have to like work together. It's like they have to there is no like this one first really, because, and it really honors that fact that like you kind of have those three different areas of the brain. You know, you have your prefrontal cortex doing the thinking and the logic, and you have your limbic system doing the emotions, and you have that brainstem kicking off that fight or flight, and your tools. It's not like one of them kicks off the other. It's not like a domino effect. It's more like a symphony. Like all parts of the brain are talking to each other and affecting each other. And then it's like a big feedback loop. And so, you know, you have these skills that are like, some of them are a little more geared towards calming down, you know, the brainstem and the fight or flight. And some of them are specifically towards, you know, speaking to that emotional brain and bringing that like cognitive section back online so you can think and not just react. And I appreciate it. It really is a holistic, you have to kind of have them all. Okay. Next question, side note, and I'll edit this out, but are you guys okay to go about 15 minutes past the hour? Okay. That I was sending an email to my next meeting. So I was like, wait, I haven't gotten to everything and this is important. Okay. All right. You have a chapter about anti-racist repair and making apologies. And you say in the book that you actually specifically put this chapter after the emotional regulation chapter. Why is that?
Yes. Another one of those intentional decisions. And I think it's because an effective repair requires a lot of emotion regulation, right? Without emotion regulation skills, it can become so easy for a repair effort to become about you. You know, when you were talking about the gravitational pull comment, I really appreciated that when you said that earlier. And I think, and it's not just like the sitting with distress, there's like the willingness to be vulnerable that's really important. And, you know, part of repair is kind of really being thoughtful about next steps and actually doing what's effective. And you can't engage in thoughtful, meaningful, intentional conversation if you're still in that panicked state and being really concerned about how you're being perceived, you know, being mad that someone's recording the incident or, you know, or whatever. And so those really need to be, I wouldn't say mastered. I don't know if anyone ever really like masters these, but having some practice in them, I think is really helpful before engaging in that, especially because evaluating your emotions is part of repair, the skill.
And I think also one of the things that came up a lot for us in our early trainings is people really wanting to jump into the, well, but what do I do? Like, what do they do for other people without the slowing down to attend to the internal work? That's also very much a part of this process. Like, okay, well, what do I say? What do I do? And again, in this way, that felt very checklisty without, again, really having to attend to the difficult internal work that's part of this process.
It makes me wonder too, like, you know, when we first, as white people, we first wake up to, oh my God, this is the reality. We're also having to feel pain in a way that we didn't before because we weren't connected to the reality of it. And I wonder sometimes if like my early urgency to like run into like, what do I do? How do I make a difference? How do I, like, how much of that, and it's both, right? Like it's both and, but like some of that was this empathy and this conviction from my values. But I wondered too, like how much of us, what's driving us is, I don't know how to tolerate the pain that I feel being open to this. And I certainly don't know how to tolerate the powerlessness that I can't fix it. So what can I do? What can I do? What can I do so that I don't have to feel powerless anymore? And we can lose the step of making sure what we're doing is effective and making sure that we are effective before we rush into, you know, whatever we're trying to do. And that's something that I thought about a lot while I was reading your book.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about that, like rushing to what can I do? The other thing that a lot of anti-racist scholars also talk about is like stamina building. When we just jump into the what do I do, then you have sort of the burnout or nothing I do works, right? This, which then leads people back to the other extreme of disengaging. And so acquiring the emotion regulation skills, the stress tolerance skills, we also see as, again, necessary internal work, but also stamina building skills.
And I'm not talking about a lot of them in this one, but I want the audience to know, like, your use of examples is so helpful. You use so many examples, interpersonal examples about people at work, people with friends. I appreciated that you used examples of somebody making online content because there are no resources for, okay, if you are somebody with an online platform, how, because there's some nuances there that you're like, I'm trying to apply what I know, but I've never seen anybody kind of outline what that's supposed to look like here. I thought that was really helpful. You have this chapter on how to call out other white people when they make racist missteps. And that's one that I thought we could go over too briefly. It's the acronym is Call Out. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So at its core, you know, calling out racism is about identifying and challenging instances of racist behavior, language, attitudes that you witness, whether it's a colleague, whether it's a family member, a friend. And one of the things that we also note in the book that I think is important to say, I know that there's some debate in the anti-racist space about whether we should be calling out or calling in. We use that language of call out flexibly, right? That allows people to make decisions given the context at hand, like whether it's done publicly or privately. We sort of trust individuals to take in the necessary contextual information to decide that. And so call out is in a lot of ways similar to DBT's Dear Man acronym, which is about what to say when you want to make a request or what to say if you want to say no, and then how to say it. For us, we take that same kind of framing of what to say and how to say it with how to respond to a racist incident. And so for C, right, it's to clarify what happened. And this is really about getting everybody on the same page, right? So if you witness a colleague saying a microaggression, say, hey, I noticed that, you know, you gave so-and-so a compliment that they're really articulate, as a way, again, reminding us or getting everybody on the same page about what happened. Acknowledge possible intentions. So I know when you said that, perhaps it was meant as a compliment or you were really just trying to praise how they describe something. Because one of the things that we recognized is people oftentimes, understandably so, get so hung up on what they meant as opposed to the impact of what they did. And so in an effort to kind of short circuit some of the defensiveness that could come up, like acknowledging it, almost like giving the person the benefit of the doubt. We know there are people who intentionally want to be racist, but let's assume that this was coming perhaps not from a racist place, or that they didn't mean it in that way. And then laying out the reasons it's racist, not assuming that everybody has the same education that you have about why calling a person of color articulate is a microaggression. To say, oh, you know, when you do that, it presumes that you didn't expect them to speak English well or to speak it properly, which may be making assumptions about their intellect, perhaps inferiority, or maybe their nation of origin, and then list possible solutions. Right. So providing the person with information for how they can prevent making this misstep again. You know, like when I went to this training, I learned that calling a person of color articulate is a microaggression. Perhaps you can attend that training too. Or the next time you want to compliment that coworker, maybe talk about their task, not a personal attribute, right? Because it gives people clear direction. And then the OUT acronym is about how you do it. So making sure that you're observing your internal reactions, using humility. I know, Casey, you kind of brought this up earlier. This is not your opportunity to try to one-up the person you're calling out or to show how you're the good ally with all the information, but really remembering what it was like for you the last time you were called out or made a misstep and trying to bring that same humility to this interaction. And then tolerating resistance. One of the things that we've also noticed or observed with some allies is anytime they get any kind of pushback, they disengage. So even if the coworker is like, well, you know, you're being too sensitive, I didn't mean it like that, reassert why it's racist, why it's problematic. This is not an invitation to go into an ineffective back and forth, right? You also have to know when it's time to disengage, but it doesn't mean that at the first sign of tension, you have permission to walk away.
Hey, if you enjoyed my episode on IEPs and you want to listen to more podcast episodes about IEPs, I want to tell you about another podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season, the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ertube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. You might have heard me talk about IEPs on my episode, and this latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. I checked out these episodes, and I think that they are a great place for you to go after listening to mine. They go into a little more detail and answer a little more in depth about what an IEP is and whether your child needs one. So listen to Understood Explains by searching for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains.
When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we're alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes a life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present, when the future no longer is a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean when you have a child to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
I love that. When you were talking about like, this isn't the chance to like one up, you know, whatever. And I just, this is so dumb, but my friends and I that are content creators, we call it the white woman woke off. And we had to recognize it in ourselves first, but now like sometimes we'll text each other and we'll be like, somebody in my comments trying to get me to do a white woman woke off.
Don't take the bait.
Don't take the bait. Okay. Well, I love that. And I wanted to also clarify for the audience that this is for white people calling out other white people. This is not for you to critique how a person of color is calling you out.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay. And then one thing I loved in the book because of how practical it was is your DEI calculator. As someone who has written a book and is writing a new one that wants input from people of color, that wants to make sure I don't just sort of accidentally write from just my own perspective, you know, I want to reach out and ask my colleagues or people that I know or people that I know of, you know, hey, what do you think of this? Or, you know, can you collaborate with me on this? But there is this fear of like, will that be offensive? Will they think like, oh, you're just asking me because I'm Black? Or, you know, if I have a question about something and it's like, well, I don't want to call my friend and have her feel like I just call her for because she's Black. And so you have this like very cool calculator about when you're working on a project and you want to elicit the viewpoints or participation or contribution of a person of color, like how to decide how to do that. So will you guys talk about that calculator for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a lot of situations where asking people of color and especially women of color for DEI related labor could make sense. And there are a lot of times where it really doesn't make sense. And I think this skill really came from the many, many experiences that we've had where it did not make sense and it did not feel good and was frustrating. And, you know, I think DEI calculator is probably our longest skill, right, Natalie? It has probably the most letters compared to all of them, which I think really captures how complex of a task, you know, you just think it's so easy, like, oh, let me just ask this person, but it really is quite complicated. And that's kind of where it came from. And I'll try to keep this brief and de-identified, but I think one of the examples that where it's like, okay, it's deeper than that was a few years ago at in a previous job after kind of like a racist incident, there was kind of this, you know, that organizational kind of desire for anti-racism and kind of a discussion of like, okay, you know, what do we do? And there was a request from my boss to, okay, well, you know, Yara, you can make like an anti-racism resource list. And, you know, notably, that wasn't part of my job. But to be fair, you know, they knew that that was an interest of mine. And of course, I'm happy to create an anti-racism resource list. And at the same time, I'm like, okay, I really think the way to go here would be like a anti-racism or DEI needs assessment in this organization, especially because I knew a lot of the issues that people of color were having in this organization. And I'm like, this is the perfect opportunity to go through, do an honest self-assessment, and then make decisions and make goals specifically based on the issues that are happening within this organization. And I found the tools, gave them to the supervisors, and it was very clear that they were not interested in doing that work. They're just like, oh yeah, that sounds good. But they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to sit with the difficult process of really assessing how the organization is doing in terms of anti-racism. And that therefore made that request for spending hours creating this resource list feel so worthless. It's like, what's this for? I'm not doing this for me. It doesn't really sound like y'all are going to use it that much, right? Like the commitment to anti-racism was really weak, and it wasn't contributing to a long-term strategic anti-racism plan. It was like a little band-aid fixing like an ambiguous wound that potentially didn't, like, what problem is an anti-racism resource list actually solving in this organization? Nothing. And so I just remember being really, really frustrated by that and thinking about, you know, years later, had they gone through the DEI calculator skill, they would have realized that this wasn't a good ask. And so as you go through the calculator, you gain what we refer to as equity bucks. And the more equity bucks you have, the more acceptable it is to ask a person of color for DEI related labor. And the outcomes are basically red, yellow, and green that refer to kind of the intensity with which to ask the request. And, you know, going back, I was kind of going through that. I'm like, okay, they probably would have had $2 max. And that is very clearly in the red zone. They should not have asked. But importantly, we talk about how there are ways to move into the yellow and green zone. Like, there are contextual things that you can change about your request to make it more appropriate. So it's not like you're in the red zone, never ask, you're on your own. It's like, really think about how to make this sustainable and not exploitative.
And I will say, you know, I didn't mention it before now, but I want the audience to know that I found this not only a helpful book for just me as a individual person, but also I'm so impressed that it also is a helpful book for me as a business owner, me as a part of an organization. Like, an organization could use this to be a better anti-racist organization. Like, there's tools in there that apply to thinking about things in that way, not just me thinking as an individual. So I wanted to kind of land the plane here with maybe one last question, if you guys would be open to it. There's this one line in the book that I found myself having an emotional reaction to and feeling a resistance to. And I'm curious if we could use this as like an example of, I can share with you what I was feeling, and you can maybe share with me like what tools in the book, you know, if I was your friend and I called you up and I was like, this is what I'm feeling, what tools in the book would be my next step for like how to move through that? So there's a part in the book where you're talking about white supremacy culture and this tool of self-preservation and how, you know, we feel like we have a right to comfort. And we feel like the threat that we feel when we're being called a racist, it, like, in that moment, it almost feels as important as the threat that a person of color would feel by the actual racism. Anyways, the point is, there's this line that says, however, for white people unencumbered by the weight of marginalization, that act of self-preservation is rarely, if ever, necessary. And so I found myself feeling resistance to this, and specifically as a woman. And I think there's this interesting thing that happens as a white woman where I feel like I have this experience of needing to engage in self-preservation constantly in my role as a woman, but not necessarily in my role as a white person. And I felt that pull of, but wait, part of it is, even when I look at Karen's, I'm like, yeah, like, yes, Karen is entitled, but part of it is that, like, she is so shit on by her own, like, patriarchal situation that she is like squeezed to the brink, and then she gets in a situation where she perceives just even more disrespect, right? With her, and you marry that with her racism of like, these people are beneath me and their disrespect. And it's like, she already gets so much of that from men that it just like pops. And so I felt this like, wait a second. No, like, as a woman, I engage in self-preservation. So if that was kind of where I was and I didn't know what to do with that feeling, what are the tools in your book that would be like my next step right there?
I think it's such a complex question. And I think, you know, and specifically what we're referring to is the weight of racial marginalization, as it's kind of implied. But not clearly stated there. So I just wanted to clarify that and also say, I mean, I think immediately my mind went to the feel skill and sitting with it. And then my mind personally, I'm curious, Natalie, what our reliability on this would be, but is kind of going to the facts skill and really asking, you know, yourself, like if we had more time, I would like ask you these questions now, but just really asking yourself, like, what are the interpretations that are happening? I think sometimes, especially when you get into talking about intersectionality and intersecting systems of oppression, there can be a misunderstanding among white women that the system of sexism is not real, or because you're a white woman, you don't experience sexism, which is of course not what intersectionality is about at all. So that would kind of be one of the things I would be curious about is, what are the interpretations? Is there an assumption of invalidation? Other things, and then really kind of questioning that, like, is that invalidation actually happening, and kind of going through the process of checking the facts?
Yeah, I was thinking feel as well. I was also thinking about detect. And I think, Yara, you kind of named it detect, like what I'm noticing resistance. I'm curious about what the emotion is, what's getting activated. Perhaps that provides some insight. It also made me think about the accept skill that also has the worldview assessment attached to it, right? Does this resistance reveal some worldviews that I have about my positionality as a white woman that are being threatened? Does it raise questions for me too around my divestment from whiteness, right? And thinking about what the function is if I lean into the gender marginalization but not really sit with the racial privilege, like what's the function of that? It also makes me think about the and skill, right? Can we hold both, right? That I benefit from whiteness and I may experience marginalization in light of these other social identities, but what's the function of me trying to play up or lean into the other types of marginalization that quote unquote may let me off the hook in terms of my anti-racism work? So I think there's a lot there.
It's just so cool because I feel like, you know, I've had so many brilliant, mostly Black women, but some Black men as well, and non-binary folks, like kind of walk through what to do with that process. But you guys are the first ones that wrote it down in a step by step by like this idea of like, okay, sit with the feelings, feel the feelings, get grounded, pass the panic, you know, look into some of these cognitive, like, is that even what they said? What am I? Is there this fear? What's the fear? Oh, there's this invalidation. This invalidation. Okay. Well, that's where, you know, I'm wanting to really address my invalidation, but like, where are we? What are we thinking about? What's the North Star? Like, what's the next step for advancing anti-racism? Like, is it really, you know, needing these people in front of me to validate this thing of me? Or like, maybe it's my job to validate that, like, that's real and hold those ands and like moving forward. And I just think that is my favorite part of the book is how practical it is and that roadmap that you guys have given. And so I just wanted to say again that I really, really love the book. I appreciate the book. When does the book come out, by the way?
April.
April 2024. Yes. Excellent. All right. Well, that's wonderful. Where can they go if they want to? Do you guys have a pre-order sale? Where will it be available?
Oh, I was just going to say it's available everywhere. So on Amazon, apparently even on Walmart, but also we're trying to get into more local bookstores. But yeah, if you just search Beyond Fragility, a skills-based guide to effective anti-racist allyship, that's how you can find it.
Awesome. And if they wanted to follow your organization, where would they learn more about that?
Yeah, we have a website. We also have Instagram. Yara, do you want to give the website information?
Yeah. So the website is www.thedearproject.com. And on there, we have all of our information about our socials. We also have information about our workshops. There's also our information, more information about the book, some of the lovely endorsements that we have received.
And our Instagram is the.dear.project. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter.
And that's D-E-A-R. We'll put all of it in the show notes, but just for those listening. Awesome. Well, thank you guys. This has been a wonderful conversation and I really appreciate your time and I appreciate the book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be here and we really appreciate your support and validation and encouragement. It really does mean so much to us. So thank you so much.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.